Welcome to McGuire on the Wire, where you'll discover top stories and strategies in specialty tax broken down by our experts. You'll also meet leaders from across the firm who will discuss McGuire Sponsel's approach to common challenges faced by our clients.
Hello, and thank you for joining us today. Today, I want to talk about a couple of bills that recently passed Congress and the House. After a while of seeming like things have stalled out on Biden's agenda, in the summer of 2022, the House passed the CHIPS Plus Act and also the Inflation Reduction Act of 2022. These look like they have been stalled out for a while, but they were able to pass the CHIPS with bipartisan support through the Senate and the Inflation Reduction Act with only Democratic support. So these are very voluminous bills, and there's a lot in these provisions. But today we're just going to talk about some of the highlights and some of the things that CPAs and their clients really need to know about. Let's start with the CHIPS Plus Act, or CHIPS Plus Science Act. Now, what does CHIPS stand for? CHIPS stands for Creating Helpful Incentives to Produce Semiconductors. This was set up as a way to increase the production in the U.S. semiconductor industry. Now, if we look at it, this was seen as also a China competitiveness bill or other things. Really, what it comes down to is anyone who's tried to buy a car or appliances since the pandemic occurred has seen that some of those things have been delayed. And one of the biggest delays are these advanced chips that need to be used in the production of these vehicles and other things. Now, a large portion of those are built outside the U.S. Taiwan is actually one of the biggest suppliers for this. And so this is not only an economic thing, but it was a national security thing. So a lot of money was put behind this, and the idea is to advance U.S. semiconductor manufacturing capacity. Now, there's a number of different things in this bill, including $1.5 billion for Public Wireless Supply Chain Innovation Fund and other things. But one of the biggest things that people are talking about is what's called the Advanced Manufacturing Investment Credit. Now, this is a 25% credit for the construction of advanced manufacturing facilities. And 25% credit is on what they call qualified investment. Now, that's tangible property, which is erected by the taxpayer or meets the original use test, very similar to the way bonus depreciation used to be, and is integral to the operation of the advanced manufacturing facility. Now, what's key with this is with this credit, and it's put under this new portion of the code called 48D. So with the 48D credit, what's critical with it is that it's only for the portions of the manufacturing facility related to manufacturing. So office administrative portions of the building will not be included, but it does include the building and structural components. So just think for a minute, if a manufacturing company builds a $500 million facility to build semiconductors, and let's say 20 million of that is related to administrative offices. So we've got $480 million left. 25% of that goes as a tax credit to that taxpayer. Now, this is as obviously evidenced by those numbers, this is a huge dollar amount and will really push a lot of people to build these facilities. It does say that these things need to be separated out and it's going to be pushed through to the taxpayer. Now, there is a question as to exactly where the manufacturing of semiconductors begins and ends. It talks about equipment and other things related to the manufacture of semiconductors. So how far down the supply chain will this credit pull? That's something that we'll have to wait for some regulations to really determine for sure. Another key thing with this credit, though, is that taxpayers can see this as making a payment against tax. So what that means is that example I just used where you've got a $500 million facility, $480 million qualifies, so they get a tax credit of $120 million, they can claim that as a payment against tax. So what that means is when they fill out their tax return at the end of the year, if they did not owe $120 million worth of tax, they would end up getting a refund at the end of the year. So this can be really beneficial to a lot of taxpayers that qualify. Now, there is some recapture that they would have to worry about. Recapture amounts drop by about 20% per year. And then you would have to worry about the reduction of basis, very similar to other credits. And there's some intersection there with credits. Obviously, we would have to look at the intersection of credits as it relates to solar, wind, geothermal, also when you start talking about rehab tax credits. Anything that you're taking a rehab tax credit on, you can't also take this credit on, et cetera. Now, because of the dollar amount, I don't think people would be interested in the rehab tax credit. They're just going to go after this because it's much more valuable than that. But it can be combined with other things. Because of the reduction in basis, you can still look at cost segregation or depreciation studies on top of this, because what'll happen is you'll reduce your basis by the amount of the tax credit, but you'll still have the remaining basis to accelerate depreciation deductions and other things. However, if you're in a position where maybe it doesn't, you're going to be getting that as a payment against tax and you won't have a tax payment that first year, you might hold off on some of those depreciation things and then wait till the following year and file a 3115. But because of the way it flows through as a payment against tax and it will come through as a refund, you might not want to maximize your tax deductions in the year you place the facility in service. So for example, on my $480 million facility, let's say that gets completed in 2023. They take that credit. That makes basically means they've overpaid their taxes for the year, they get a refund. Well, they might want to hold off on their depreciation deductions until the next year when they can utilize them to reduce their tax bill. However, at the same time, they could use those in 2023 because it's going to reduce their tax liability even further, which will then get them a larger refund because of the way this credit works. So depending on how they want to use it and how they want to balance cash flow, they can still look at things like depreciation and other things on top of this. That's the biggest portion of the CHIPS bill. Obviously, there's other things in it. There's going to be $500 billion to be allocated for the Commerce Department semiconductor incentive. There's a CHIPS for America Defense Fund. They put in funding for other different areas, including educational aspects of this, because they realize the workforce is not there and ready to handle this. So there's a lot of training and other things that go into this. So first the Senate passed that, and then about a day after the Senate passed CHIPS Plus science bill, Senators Schumer and Manchin announced that they had come to an agreement on one of Biden's biggest policy issues, and that was this environmental bill that included adjustments to taxation. Now, if we go back a year ago, this was what people were referring to as the Build Back Better plan. Now, this is a greatly shrunk down Build Back Better. It's about a third of the size that the Build Back Better was, and it's now known as the Inflation Reduction Act. And this was specifically designed that it could go through the reconciliation process, so the Democrats would only need 50 votes to pass it. They ended up passing it with exactly 50 votes. Republicans all voted against it with 50 votes, and then the vice president was pulled in to be the tiebreaker. And so this was seen as a way to push through a lot of the agenda of the Biden presidency, including a lot of environmental things. Specifically, there's about $370 billion to address domestic energy and security and climate change. There's also $5 billion in drought relief for the western states. That was actually a key thing that Kyrsten Sinema wanted added to it. Kyrsten Sinema was another holdout along with Manchin, and she negotiated that $5 billion. There's a deficit reduction portion of this on $6 billion. And there's also three more years of subsidies for the ACA under the American Rescue Plan of 2021. They've added another 3 years of subsidies to that. So that's the Obamacare subsidies that came out during the pandemic. They've extended that. How does it pay for it? Well, the first thing that most people are aware of is there's this 15% corporate minimum tax rate. And this 15% corporate minimum tax rate, that's expected to raise just over $300 billion. There's also another about $288 billion that's going to be raised by the ability of Medicare to negotiate drug prices, reducing the cost that Medicare would pay. They're expected that to be about $288 billion. There'll be a 1% excise tax on stock buybacks. That's supposed to raise about $73 billion. And then there's this IRS enforcement. And depending on where you're watching the news, you've seen different things about this. And really, the facts of the matter is it would add about $80 billion for the IRS. It'll add about 87,000 IRS agents. And that's expected to increase Treasury receipts by about $200 billion. So you take out the cost of it at $80 billion, it would be seen as a revenue raiser. They're estimating about $124 billion. So let's start with that portion of it. It's increased IRS enforcement. And what does that mean? Well, for most people, they're not going to see much of any change, the average taxpayer. But for a lot of business owners, high net worth individuals, and CPAs that work with them, this could be a big change because it will increase the ability for the IRS to look at certain things. So I was actually talking to one of the people in our international tax practice, and we were talking about international tax compliance and things like transfer price studies and other things where a lot of times when the IRS finds it, this can be a headache for a lot of people because they're not necessarily done right. Maybe they don't have all of the paperwork filed, etc. And these areas of compliance are going to become much more critical. Goes to where I work on the cost segregation side. For years, the IRS has not had the ability to actually look to see if work was being done on a quality basis. If the IRS has the enforcement potential, there's a chance that they might go after some of that as well. Now, that shouldn't raise any red flags with people that are doing it correctly. The IRS isn't going to spend a lot of time with people that are doing things correctly, but it will give them a chance to make sure that people are doing these things correctly and have this understanding. Now, let's talk then about this 15% book minimum tax. So the way this will work is there's going to be a 15% minimum tax on book earnings applied to companies with profits of more than $1 billion. And this is calculated on a three-year floating average. So what they're going to do is look at your last 3 years and determine what your book profits were. If they average over that $1 billion, there's this 15% minimum tax. Now, there are some adjustments allowed to be made between, like for depreciation, for example. You can take back out your book depreciation, add in what you're allowed to under 167, to which 168 applies, and determine how that adjusts it. So for example, with bonus depreciation and other things, you can still take that into consideration. So that might make actually maximizing depreciation much more important for some of these large corporations where maybe depreciation was a secondary afterthought in the past. That might become much more important because of the fact that it comes after the 15% tax. Also, domestic credits such as the R&D credit would be allowed to offset up to 75% of the tax. So as you can see, it's not as clean as just saying 15% on minimum tax on book earnings, but even that is not clean because obviously book earnings have a lot of different standards than tax earnings. So we've got to really look at how some of this flushes out as the IRS comes out with regulations on how they're going to do it. Now, there's a lot of other things in here. Like I said, this was primarily for energy. So there's a lot of things like electric car credits. There are a number of these credits that's going up to $7,500. Electric vehicle tax credits, and that was renewed from January 2023 through 2032. But there are some changes to the existing credits, including removing the $200,000 vehicle cap starting in 2023. And they're going to start allowing it to be put at the point of sale. But there are going to be new requirements, including U.S. assembly and a requirement that critical materials need to come from the U.S. or country with a free trade agreement with the U.S. starting in 2024. Now, we've already seen news reports that car companies are starting to work on that because they don't necessarily have that in place yet, which is part of the reason that does not actually become instituted for another year and a half. However, that's still difficult for people to completely change where they're getting their supplies from in that short an order. So we'll have to see how that works out. Additionally, in order to qualify, vehicles must have an MSRP of under $55,000 for cars and $80,000 for SUVs and trucks. And there are income thresholds. You don't get the credit if you make more than $150,000 for an individual, $300,000 married to qualify. Now, there is a lower credit for used cars. However, that drops down to $25,000 or less in terms of the MSRP on the car, and the income caps drop to $75,000, $150,000 if you're married. So this is going to be interesting to see how all this works out. The used car one probably is going to be the easier one to implement in the early stages, just simply because you don't have to worry about some of that manufacturing restrictions until some of the car companies actually figure out how to push that through. So we still don't know exactly which cars starting in 2023 and then later in 2024, once the materials requirement comes into play, are going to qualify for this. So we'll have to wait and see as that plays out and exactly how some of these things will work out as we move forward. I mentioned when we were talking about the CHIPS bill, this new advanced manufacturing credit for the production of semiconductors. Now, there's also a production credit included in the Inflation Reduction Bill. And that's a tax credit for the production of clean energy components. And this includes solar components, wind turbine components, inverters, batteries, critical materials, and other things. And this is going to be a production credit, so it's based on the number of components that are produced. So this is going to be an interesting thing to see how this plays out too, as it might combine with what's in the CHIPS bill. If we're building more semiconductors, that might lead to more solar components and other things being produced in the U.S. in the near future because of this production requirement. And the idea is to get this more on stage with where some of the rest of the world is in terms of the cost of these materials. One of the other things that we get asked a lot about is how 179D and 45L are changing. First, let me point out that as I'm recording this, we are still in 2022. Nothing changes for 2022 as it relates to 179D, and 45L gets a one-year extension from the end of 2021 till the end of 2022. And 45L looks exactly the same as it did in the past. However, starting in 2023, both of these things change, and they change relatively dramatically. So first, on 179D, the energy standard changes, and you need to have a 25% increase versus a 50% increase, and then you get a push on your deduction up to that 50%. So let me give you an example. It starts off that with a 25% increase over the standard, you get a maximum deduction of 50 cents. And for every percentage increase up to 50%, you get an increase in your deduction of 2 cents per square foot. So it goes from 50 cents to $1 per square foot. So then what happens is that can then get pushed, and you get to multiply it by 5 up to a $2.50 up to $5 per square foot deduction if you meet what's called the prevailing wage requirements, which the prevailing wage requirements are going to require that the Secretary of Labor is going to set certain wages and that you need to pay wages not less than the prevailing wage rates. It's also going to require some apprenticeship requirements. Now, we're not 100% sure yet how this is going to be enforced, if this is just going to be a certification that you create or something else. This should come into play starting in 2023, so we'll need to see how that plays out. The other thing that changes on 179D is that there will be a transfer available by tax-exempt entities. So in the past, 179D could be transferred to the person or persons primarily responsible for the energy-efficient design in the case of government-owned properties. So in the case that I'm sitting here in the state of Indiana, if the state of Indiana builds a new state house, the architect who designed it could have the 179D deduction transferred back to them. That is going to be extended to tax-exempt entities as well, starting in 2023. They also changed 45L. So for those that aren't aware, 45L is a tax credit for up to $2,000 for the construction of energy-efficient single-family homes. Now, what happens is this gets extended through 2031. Now, it's increased for single-family homes up to $2,500, and it can increase to $5,000 for eligible homes certified as Zero Energy Ready under the Department of Energy's Zero Energy Ready Home Program. With multifamily homes, the base credit goes from down to $500, $1,000 if it's certified as Zero Energy Ready under the Department of Energy Zero Energy Ready Home Program, and it can increase to $2,500 to $5,000 if prevailing wage requirements are met. Now, I will tell you, some of the standards that we're using now for 45L change, and we're not 100% sure how that's going to work out because some of the requirements are going to get more stringent on this, and then that base credit, when we're talking about single-family homes, does increase, but when we talk about multifamilies, apartment complexes, and other things, that base credit drops unless you're in the prevailing wage requirements. So we'll have to see how some of that plays out as the IRS creates the regulations, how they're going to go off of it. We also need to look at exactly how they take these ENERGY STAR requirements that are going to be utilized and how they interpret them. Because there are places in the code where it talks about three stories or less with multifamily homes, but in the new standards that they're requiring, it does not have that. So we'll have to see exactly where all of this plays out. With this, though, it could potentially increase significantly, but we'll have to wait and see as the regulations come out. So over the next few months, we'll be watching very carefully as the IRS starts to create guidance as to exactly how companies are supposed to go after all this. Finally, we saw a change to the research tax credit. Unfortunately, we did not, and I'll repeat, we did not get the change for the amortization yet. We're expecting that to be probably pushed through in some type of tax extenders bill. But we did see a change where in the case of startup businesses where the research tax credit can be used against payroll taxes, currently you could get up to $250,000 of the credit towards payroll taxes. After 12/31/2022, there's going to be an additional credit of another $250,000, so a total of about $500,000 that can be used against payroll taxes. So these are just some of the highlights in this bill. In order to keep this under a specific time frame, I'm not going to go into everything on these bills. These are very voluminous, and there's a lot of information in these. But if you have questions about these or anything else related to these bills, feel free to reach out to your McGuire Sponsor representative, and we'll try to walk you through this. And as we start seeing some of the regulations come out related to these, we will be updating our guidance. We'll be having more podcasts and also webinars to walk people through some of these changes. But in the meantime, feel free to reach out to us if you do have any questions. Thank you.
This has been McGuire on the Wire. Thanks so much for listening. If you enjoyed the show, be sure to subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts and follow us on social @McGuireSponsel to get more industry news and firm updates.